Welcome back to China Beyond the Great Wall. I'm Mike Kuliska.
And I'm Elizabeth Murray. We are a part of a group of 10 University of Illinois journalism students who actually looked beyond the Great Wall for ourselves. Our journey was part of an international reporting class at the U of I with Professor Nancy Benson.
You may ask, why China? Most people are already connected to China in some way or the other, since most of the products we buy, like jogging shoes, computers, clothing, or flat-screen televisions, are made in China.
And there are news reports about China nearly every day. For most of us, headlines about the booming economy, violation of human rights, pollution, and internet restrictions form our image of China. But we forget that China is a very old country. Its history is more than 3,600 years old, at least as far as the records go.
And if it weren't for China, we wouldn't have paper, gunpowder, or a compass. China was ahead of other civilizations with the invention of those products, as well as the development of porcelain, printed books, the calendar, even umbrellas and kites.
China has long been at the center of the world's rich history of trade. Merchants were busy traveling the Silk Road. The most important pre-modern trade road linking China to Europe was the gateway for commodities such as spices, teas, jade, bronze, and silk.
China had a long period of dynastic rule. The last and longest was the Qing dynasty, which was overthrown in 1911. In modern history, the rise of the communists in 1949 and the Cultural Revolution alienated China from much of the Western world. The exchange of goods and other relations almost disappeared overnight. It took about 30 years for China to open up again when Deng Xiaoping set the country on a different path in the 80s. And now China, once again, is a major player on the world stage.
2008 is a very important year for China, in particular for the capital, Beijing. People from all across the planet will look toward Beijing when it hosts the Olympics next summer. Right now, much of the city is under construction, which is kicking up a lot of dust. Liz Rising has more on how China is preparing for the Olympic Games.
The sounds of construction echo across Beijing as China prepares to host the 2008 Summer Olympics. With highways, subway lines, and athletic venues being built and prepped to host the games in Beijing, all eyes are on China as the country steps onto the world stage. Olympic official Zhang Yang says the dust will settle on most construction sites by the end of this year.
We have 31 competition venues, all of them except the national stadium, will be completed by the end of this year. And the largest one, we call it the Bird's Nest, will be completed at the beginning of next year.
Trial runs are underway to test everything before the games begin.
We are testing our teams, working teams, our people. Some of our people are not very familiar with, you know, sports competitions, and they are going to acquire some practical knowledge, practical skill through the test events. And we are testing the city operations. The city will support this, the test events, in terms of logistics, in terms of, you know, transport.
All of Beijing is preparing for their international guests. Olympic Village will host athletes from all participating countries, while the National Conference Center will be home base for broadcast operations. An estimated 6,000 journalists from different countries will have credentials. In an effort to beautify Beijing, 533 acres of forest are being planted and tended around the airport and venues. Zhang is confident that preparations are moving along as planned, and that Beijing Organizing Committee for the Games of the 29th Olympiad, or BOCOG, has the backing of all of China.
And we enjoy very strong support from the Chinese government, Beijing Municipal Government, and we enjoy strong support from the general public.
BOCOG expects 3.2 million motor vehicles on Beijing highways by the 2008 Games, a 16% increase from the number of cars traveling the roadways today. BOCOG has a plan to fight congestion.
Last year, Beijing built over 160 kilometers of roads in the city, and we upgraded some relevant facilities. The overpass and the major crossroads has been improved, and we have given priority to development of public transportation facilities in Beijing. We optimized bus lines, and we are building more subways in Beijing to reduce the congestion of traffic.
And Beijing's taxi drivers say they're optimistic about the future.
I feel very, very excited about it. I think Olympic it's not only great opportunities for only Beijing, but also for the whole China. I think right now, because of Olympics, Beijing is becoming more and more international. Of course, I feel very, very excited about the Olympics, because I think getting the bid of 2008 Olympics represents our country is becoming more and more stronger. And personally, I of course welcome the Olympics to Beijing, because we can get more opportunities. And there are a lot of foreigners will come, and we can definitely experience a very fast development, just like South Korea, and we can definitely get more chances from the Olympics.
Not far from where the sites are being built, some Chinese athletes are training hard for the upcoming competition. Chinese national shooting team member Yang Zhaolei is studying at Tsinghua University. She's hoping to make the 2008 Summer Games team and says that training is a top priority.
The Tsinghua is a 10 class, so we training in Tsinghua and from Tuesday for Sunday, 6 days.
Training at Tsinghua is convenient for Yang. The team's shooting range is located on campus, directly above the university's hotel. Yang competes in the air rifle division. She and her teammates wear leather protective gear to prevent any rifle mishaps. They practice cocking and aiming their rifles for 10 minutes before they are allowed to fire any shots. Yang says she devotes much of her time to her team, which doesn't leave room for much else.
I haven't enough time to shopping and play. Just training.
One of Yang's classmates, Hu Chen, also has Olympic aspirations. Hu competes in the 100-meter hurdles at Tsinghua University and has begun training for the Games. Hu says he's dreamed of this moment for as long as he can remember.
I think a player's dream is to join the Olympic Games. So when I was a little boy, I dreamed one day if I running or fighting in the Olympic Games, so I think it's my honor.
Prime Minister of Physical Education at Fudan University, Wang Chuen, says talent among athletes in China is closely monitored.
In our country, the training method to train a professional athlete is mainly focused on professional skills. And if they reach a certain level of competing skills in primary school, they will receive professional training in other schools. Meanwhile, some athletes will go to colleges, and those colleges have a traditional strong aspect of competing, mainly focus on the sporting events.
More than 1 million international spectators are expected to visit Beijing during the Games. Volunteers are being recruited to serve as interpreters and translators. Volunteer Shang Yan says there will be many demands placed on them as well.
I want to improve my oral English and make friends with foreigners. Maybe one day I want to go abroad to study, for more study. I think this also useful for me.
Shang says she wants the people she helps to leave China with a warm feeling about her homeland.
I hope I can help some foreigners here and show the ways and gather for them, give his a good impression in China. Also, I think Chinese people very, very warm. I hope the foreigners can like my China and like Chinese people and like Chinese culture.
Image is a concern for Bokog. Zhang says he knows what kind of image China wants to project.
Through the Beijing Olympic Games, we are going to project an image which is, you know, of our society, which is freer, opener, and prosperous. That is what we are, you know, the message we are sending to the international community.
Zhang says the rules have been loosened in China to grant visiting journalists more access, but he adds that the more open environment for the media won't last.
We will switch back to the old system after the Olympic Games. You know, some change, if it is good, it will leave a memory, or it will leave an impact. I think it is a progress. I think it is a good start. I think we should, you know, continue our efforts in that direction.
And Zhang hopes that the Olympics will serve as an eye-opener to a country with rich tradition and a quickly developing future. In Beijing, I'm Liz Rising.
Lack of free press is just one of the points of criticism China faces from other countries. In light of global warming, the amount of pollution China generates is also controversial. Smoke from factories poses a health threat. But some of the environmental hazards are not so easy to solve. Scientists say global warming is disturbing the weather patterns in China, bringing more sandstorms to Beijing each year. That's when the red sand of the Gobi Desert blows in, turning the sky in China's capital blood red. The government is trying to calm the desert dust by planting trees. And economic growth is exacting a price as well. The expanding economy, growing middle class and rising prosperity means there are more and more cars on the roads, especially in metropolitan centers, as Sam Unger reports.
Roughly 1,000 new cars hit Beijing roads each day, according to Chinese government estimates, meaning vehicle emissions are quickly becoming a major contributor to dirty air. Combine that with the fact that more than 70% of China's electricity is generated from coal, and the air quality outlook is rather bleak. Pollution is a major concern among athletes competing in the 2008 Summer Olympics in Beijing. They're worried about health problems that could result from inhaling toxic pollutants that linger in the air. And for that reason, the Olympic Committee and the government are quick to point out that they're cleaning things up. Zhang Yang is a spokesperson for the Beijing Olympic Committee.
We have been promoting economic restructuring because, you know, the pollution comes from, you know, mainly comes from industries. So we have shut down some polluting plants, and we have, you know, cut down the outputs of some polluting plants. And we are moving, you know, some polluting plants from Beijing to some other areas.
And if that's not enough, officials say there are emergency measures that can be taken during the Games. One of the agencies that will monitor pollution levels during the Games is the Beijing Environmental Protection Bureau. BEPB engineer Jinghui Liu says her agency will use a fleet of special vehicles to provide real-time air and weather field reports.
Each of the 8 departments have their own forecast systems. Once some emergencies happen, they will report them to the Department of Engineering, and the Department of Engineering will report to the mayor of Beijing, and he will make the decision.
Emergency measures include limiting the number of private cars on the roads or temporarily closing certain factories. But the impact of air pollution in China reaches far beyond the 2008 Olympic Games. For at least one-third of China's population, the air they breathe doesn't meet international health guidelines, and that means an increased risk of certain diseases like cancer. At Fudan University in Shanghai, Dr. Song Weimin heads the Department of Environmental Health. He says the air pollution problem is so severe that even in less polluted parts of the country, pollution death rates are still high.
It's better in the southern part of China. The air quality is much better than 10 years ago, but compare it to other American or European cities, it's still a very high level of pollution.
And he says since China's economy will continue to rapidly expand, health problems associated with air pollution won't be going away anytime soon.
China is an energy-consuming country, and it is impossible for her to totally switch from coal power to clean power, such as nuclear, wind, solar, and water, in the coming decade. But maybe the situation will be better in 2050.
And at the global scale, scientists say one of the most pressing issues related to China's air pollution is climate change. While many experts believed it wouldn't happen for a few more years, a study completed by a Dutch research group found China has recently overtaken the United States as the world's leading producer of the greenhouse gas, carbon dioxide, which many scientists believe contributes to global climate change. The deputy director of the China Meteorological Administration's Beijing Climate Center, Luo Yang, says China is both a contributor to and a victim of climate change.
We have more and more extreme events, such as the heat wave, torrential rain, as well as the typhoon in the West Pacific Ocean. So under the background of climate change, the extreme events has increased both in the intensity and the frequency.
But he says reducing air pollution and mitigating climate change isn't just China's responsibility.
Carbon dioxide has a long lifetime in the atmosphere, for the 50 to 200 years. So as I see it, most of the reason of the current climate change was caused by the accumulated the emission of greenhouse gases and the high emission per capita in the developed country.
Yang was in Shanghai attending a training course related to promoting sustainable development. Part of what he says is China's commitment to cleaning up the environment, a goal that can sometimes conflict with another goal, continued economic growth.
There is still 30 million poor people in China. So development of the economy is the priority of the future development in China. But in the meantime, China will not follow the development paths of the developed countries. We will go to another new path to promote the development of the economy and pay more attention on the environment and the climate change issues.
And it's the desire to bring about increased environmental awareness and change in her hometown that led Tsinghua University postdoc researcher Li Tao Wang to study air pollution control. She's from the town of Handan in Hebei province, where she says pollution from steel and cement production causes big problems.
In my hometown, it's very heavy, has very heavy industrials. And I think the cancer rate is very high. I know many people died from this disease. Some of my neighbors suffered from these diseases.
Which is why one day she hopes to return to Handan from Beijing to work to reduce air pollution there.
I hope I can do a big and effective project for my hometown and change the situation.
While research from China's leading universities may be one way to help solve part of the air pollution problem, others are pushing for environmental change through the legal process. In Beijing, a small complex of rooms in the basement of a dilapidated office building on the campus of the China University of Political Science and Law, home to one of the most unique and important tools in the fight for cleaner air. It's the Center for Legal Assistance to Pollution Victims, made up of a dedicated team of volunteer law students and attorneys who represent pollution victims in court cases against some of China's biggest polluters. The center has a hotline manned by student volunteers who take complaints from pollution victims. It's received more than 10,000 since it was started in 1999. But only about 15 pollution cases ever make it to court each year. The center's director, Wang Kanfa, says he hopes the role of the center will expand in coming years to have an even greater effect.
Our help cannot be limited in the cities or in East China. Our legal services have to reach Western China. And maybe we can give them the environmental legal service, and we can organize legal centers and movable help stations to give the victims help.
But litigation director Jingjing Zhang says using the law to bring about environmental change in China is far from easy.
You know, it's very hard to change the whole legal system or judicial system. It's very hard, and especially in China, we have no precedent. And even we won one case, we cannot apply to other cases. But I think the reason we still insist doing our work is we believe we can change. Without us, I think the environment, the situation will get worse. And if we still working, I think we still hope for change some part of our system.
China is a country where officials measure the success of their efforts to combat urban air pollution by the number of blue sky days each year, now around 67% in Beijing, well short of the 80% officials are hoping for during the Olympics. But the situation has gotten better, and if the efforts of those who are working hard to reduce pollution are realized, China's future could be full of blue skies once again. In Beijing, I'm Sam Unger.
While many other countries point fingers at China for polluting the air we all breathe, China is also the endpoint for much of the waste that other countries generate. For many Chinese peasants, recycling the rest of the world's waste is a source of a vital income.
Computers and electronic devices produced in China, then shipped to consumers in countries like the U.S., often come back as so-called e-waste. Small family workshops in rural China often strip the e-waste to the bone to get valuable metals like copper, and they work under hazardous conditions. Ted Lan traveled to Taizhou for this story.
The city of Taizhou is about a 40-minute flight from Shanghai. Many who travel here are on business, negotiating contracts and conducting site surveys in this industrial port city. Like clockwork, ships loaded with new products set a determined course for the United States. But it's not just what leaves the city that makes business boom, it's also what's coming in.
I know it's polluted here, but it's not a big deal. The most important thing is my children. That's the reason why I found work here.
23-year-old Liu Qingzhen works at this Taizhou scrap plant. It's an endpoint for some of the nearly 4,000 tons of scrap and e-waste that enters the port each day. She's one of hundreds of workers who squat under an outdoor pavilion picking apart old circuit boards and wires. She toils 9 hours a day, 7 days a week, earning about $130 a month. The work is dangerous. Harmful chemicals and e-waste byproducts seep out of the electronic scrap. She moved here because she needed to support her two kids.
I used to work in a shoe factory, but then I had a baby, and it's not convenient to have a baby there, so I moved here even though the pay is the same. I come from the countryside. You can't earn money on a farm.
Liu Yuin Hong also used to farm. He too left the countryside to double his yearly income at the scrap plant.
I work with my wife. That is her over there. Our son is studying and he's going to graduate from high school. Maybe he will go to the university. His life will be better than what I have.
His wife, Hu Xianzhang, strips wires at the plant.
The work is not as demanding as on the farm. It's really harder at home.
The plant where this couple works is considered safer than scrapping these materials in the countryside where families work in their front yards and in their homes. They cook circuit boards and burn wires to extract bits of valuable copper and gold. Environmental organizations have documented evidence that the byproducts of this process are dumped into local rivers and streams.
I noticed that when we arrived, they shut down the other door of that other shop. Mm-hmm.
And they are doing the same kind of e-waste, but they're afraid of being discovered by others.
Afraid, says Taizhou resident Chen Yijun, because what they're doing is illegal. Chinese law forbids the import of e-waste, yet piles of foreign electronics litter the countryside and pour into scrap plants daily. Yijun is a teacher at Taizhou No. 1 High School, where students are concerned about what the e-waste industry is doing to their environment. They've been testing the water in local streams, looking for signs of harmful chemicals. On this day, they draw several gallons from a waterway whose banks are littered with piles of electrical cable. Chen Zhenyan has been working on the project for years.
The frogs here are different from frogs in other places because sometimes they have extra limbs. We are sure the pollution is from e-waste because in this area there is no other industry.
Biology teacher Guo Xiamin.
Maybe it's a harm to human. So we can tell the government or officer to do something to improve the condition.
Liang Xiaoyang is a government official in Taizhou who says there's only so much they can do to combat an illegal industry that so many residents make their living off of. He says the solution to the e-waste problem is to cut off the imports, but that's difficult.
When the imports arrive, there is so much stuff that maybe there is a small amount of e-waste hidden in with other scrap.
A small amount that somehow manages to keep scrap plants and family shops working full time. The government doesn't deny the waste industry is big business here.
This industry generates a lot of tax money for us in the form of tariffs. So if this industry doesn't exist, the Taizhou Harbor won't survive.
Jim Puckett is coordinator of the Basel Action Network, a Seattle-based group that confronts toxic trade issues around the world. He says it's not that the Chinese government is unwilling to stop imports. Rather, they're unable.
They've banned the import. They've had this import of electronic waste banned for many years. And the United States knew full well they had this ban. Problem is, they can't control that flow. It's just coming at them container load after container load through various ports, and they can't possibly check every single one.
American recyclers and brokers are literally fueling the e-waste fires that dot the countryside. A close look at an e-waste heap reveals CD players, calculators, and computer parts, some of which the government says came from the United States.
U.S. waste usually has a high percentage of copper, and that makes it profitable even when shipping it a long distance overseas.
Springfield, Illinois, is certainly a long distance from Taizhou, about 7,000 miles, practically the other side of the globe. In this warehouse, the Illinois State Department of Central Management Services, or CMS, processes almost 11,000 discarded electronics each year, including old copy machines, computer monitors, and hard drives, all property of the state. As the sole disposer of state property, CMS holds public auctions 6 times a year to get rid of the old electronics. Anyone can come out and bid on the products sold by the pallet. There are buyers who rebuild the gear and then sell it, others donate it to charitable causes. But some buyers are thinking on a global scale. In 2005, CMS was contacted by the Basel Action Network with some disturbing information about Illinois computers. Curtis Howard is manager of CMS state and federal surplus property.
They said, hey, by the way, did you realize that some unscrupulous buyers of your property were actually selling these items and shipping them overseas? And you have these small villages like Lagos, Nigeria, where we found state of Illinois PCs. It hit me pretty hard, the fact that not realizing, you know, I always look at it, you know, these guys were here, they come in, they bid on our property, you know, I'm maximizing the return on the state's investment, I'm doing a good job. I never really thought about the tail end of the dragon.
Basel Action Network coordinator Jim Puckett says if the Chinese are unable to stop the imports, then it's up to the United States to control what they export.
Well, we have a huge responsibility here in this country because we're the only country in the world that is not controlling this export. Other countries have laws forbidding it, laws controlling it, but in the United States, we don't even have a law to control this export.
The U.S. is one of only a handful of countries that have not signed and ratified the Basel Convention, an international treaty that bans hazardous waste exports. That means it's up to the states to take action. In Illinois, CMS now categorizes scrap into 2 categories. The first is useful scrap and includes products with some value that will still be sold to the public. The idea is that no one's going to ship a perfectly good working system overseas to be scrapped. The second category is useless scrap that will go straight to a trusted local recycler and remain in the U.S. Howard says this reduces the likelihood Illinois computers will end up in developing regions of the world.
We will still sell computers, we'll still sell printers, but this time they're going to be in good working condition so that they're put into service and not trashed. If a person's going to buy a PC, at least now they're going to buy one that they can actually put into service.
This makes Illinois one of a growing number of states that have adopted e-waste programs. Locally, the cities of Champaign and Urbana have held e-scrap recycling drives where residents can bring their old electronics to a drop-off point to be recycled in a responsible manner. One such drive this past April saw nearly 850 households bring in about 70,000 pounds of scrap. Rod Fletcher is Urbana City Environmental Manager.
There's a tremendous amount of electronic scrap out there that needs to be recycled. They view their computer as a valuable item, which it is, and a lot of people are just storing those items. People are not throwing them away.
This is the power supply out of the computer, okay? These are the hard drives.
At Max Twin City Recycling in Urbana, owner Ken Mathis sees most of the electronics recycled in Champaign County. the University of Illinois is a loyal customer. Old U of I computers fill the shelves of one of the storage rooms. Workers disassemble them and sort the parts into huge boxes. Mathis says his company breaks down the electronics into something with little or no value, which reduces the chances his product will end up overseas.
It has to be ground, and it has to be mixed with copper. You know, it has to be melted. The impurities come out. What I'm sending out is a very raw product. It's not something like, you know, like a circuit board.
The process of responsibly recycling e-waste is costly and time-consuming, so it's no surprise that responsible recyclers are in the minority. The EPA reports that more than 2.5 million tons of e-waste was generated in 2005, and that only 13% of it was recycled. That means more than 2 million tons of waste was either thrown in the trash or dumped. The environmental group Greenpeace offers a solution: remove hazardous substances from electronics altogether and offer take-back programs for consumers whose products have become obsolete. Last year, they started ranking electronics manufacturers using a 1 through 10 scale on how eco-friendly their products are from the day they're manufactured to the end of their useful life. Companies like Nokia and Dell earned praise for their commitment to eliminating harmful chemicals and elements from their products. On the other end of the scale is cell phone giant Motorola, which according to Greenpeace has limited take-back options for customers wanting to get rid of their electronics. Back in Taizhou, high school students testing the polluted waters here are the generation who must deal with the long-term consequences of the e-waste problem. Cleaning up the tons of lead, mercury, and other harmful substances that have contaminated the city will take years. But those efforts won't make much of a difference if e-waste is still pouring into the country. According to the Silicon Valley Toxics Coalition, there are 500 million obsolete computers in the U.S. alone. Where these and other discarded electronics will end up ultimately depends on still unwritten trade laws that will keep electronics from making an overseas voyage. Workers who scrap e-waste here are those who will pay a price for simply trying to make a living dealing with e-waste, so the rest of the world doesn't have to. In Taizhou, I'm Ted Land.
You're listening to China Beyond the Great Wall. We, that is 10 U of I journalism students, traveled to China to get a better perspective on modern China, a melting pot of the old and the new. In some places like Jing'an Buddhist Temple in Shanghai, it's as though time stood still. Inside the temple walls is an oasis from the noisy streets of this vibrant city.
Outside, Shanghai is a hectic, fast-moving city. The Chinese economic center is constantly evolving and has about 4,000 high-rise buildings, with plans to add another 3,000 skyscrapers in the next 3 years. And if you leave the coast and head west, you find a very different picture. The majority of the Chinese population, about 800 million people, lives in rural areas.
Many of them are farmers with only small plots of land. From the air, the fields look like a patchwork of hand towels. A lot of farmers live on just $2 a day, only enough for food. So they often leave their villages and become migrant workers, making their way to China's major cities in search of a better future. Lauren Thorne-Bjornson reports on the lives of migrant workers who are trying their luck in the city.
Chang Zhengliang is a newlywed, married less than a year. But his first year of marriage hasn't been a honeymoon. 20 days after his wedding, Chang moved to Beijing to find work, leaving his bride in Qingxian, a small town in China's Hebei province.
It's because I want to earn a lot of money to feed my family. When your parents get older, you have to feed your parents, your wife, and your children, and that's all dependent on your working.
But Chang isn't earning the money he thought he would in the big city. He is making only 60 yuan a day, which is about $8, and his annual income is little over $1,000 after living expenses are deducted. Chung is just one of more than 100 million migrant workers helping to build the office towers and condos that serve as status symbols of China's booming economy. Workers face discrimination in some of the biggest cities where growth is the strongest. The fuel for the discrimination comes from China's hukou system, a policy that Tsinghua sociology professor Shen Yuan says is meant to regulate the movement of the population.
Hukou is used to control the flow ability of people from country to the city.
The hukou is a citizen registration system with local government that entitles those registered to have access to social services. The hukou doesn't transfer when a worker moves to a new city. They're still considered residents of the town where they were born, meaning they don't have the same rights as the citizens who were born in the cities they're working in. So Yuan says a rural resident moving to Shanghai or Beijing won't have access to safe housing, education for their children, medical care, or retirement and social security.
If you have a rural hukou, then you can't get these five benefits. You have to build your own house, education is not as good, you don't have medical care, and you don't have a retirement system. You still have to work until you are too old to work anymore.
Migrant workers living without these benefits have no choice, because Chung says they need the work. And in a heavily populated country like China, there is always someone ready to replace you.
My boss says if you want to find a frog with three legs, it's very hard. But if you want to find a man with two legs, there are a lot of them. So if you go away, that's fine, but there are a lot of people waiting and looking for work.
Chung has been a migrant worker since the age of 15, and during his 10 years of work, he has lived through some tough times.
I was really overburdened during some of my past jobs. When I worked there, I would get up at 5 a.m. and go to sleep at 12 at night. The boss would say, I will pay you 50 yuan, but actually only get paid 35 yuan per day.
The maximum hour work day is one of the very few labor laws protecting migrant workers, with the maximum set at 8 hours a day. But most bosses will force 10 to 12 hour working days instead. Companies are also supposed to help their workers get medical care by paying for a sanitary card. But Zhao, a worker in Shanghai, says his boss neglects his responsibilities to the workers to save himself money.
I've been here 6 years and I've not gotten the card yet.
And according to Jonathan Hirsch, founder of NGO Compassion for Migrant Children, enforcement of laws is lax. He says this can be seen with the most recent legislation meant to protect migrant children's rights to education. The Chinese government passed a compulsory education law that stated all children of migrant workers living in a city for 6 months or more must be enrolled in public schools. Hirsch says there are four barriers to this law actually being enforced.
And one is the fees that are charged to migrant kids to enter into public schools about three times higher than an urbanite. And obviously their salary is probably three times lower.
He says often there aren't enough spaces in public schools. And when there is space, migrant children may still not be allowed in.
Because they feel it taints their school's image.
And if a migrant family can get past all that, Hirsch says the children usually don't feel comfortable at a school where they are considered an outcast. But one worker says he still has hope for his son's education.
My son is in the third grade and he is doing very well, and as long as he wants to continue, I will do my best to offer him as much money no matter how much. I don't want my children to work the same way as me when they grow up.
This pressure to provide for their families keeps workers living in very cramped quarters. Chung lives in a room no larger than a hotel room that he shares with 20 people.
Our room is right next to the bathroom and the toilet, so it smells. But you have to get used to it. There are a lot of mosquitoes. It can be an unbearable thing.
And Chung says after a day's work, there is little chance to feel refreshed.
It's not easy for me to get a shower. It's always a cold shower without hot water, even in the winter.
And this can make workers self-conscious around other citizens. In Beijing, workers share their thoughts.
Many people just look down on us. Our clothes are dirty and we look untidy. But some people say we are so dirty and won't let us drink their water because they say we are too dirty. Since all people are born equal, why do people look down on us? It is unfair.
In these conditions, sickness among workers is not uncommon. But without health insurance or money to spend on a doctor, Chung says workers either return home or try to cure themselves.
Once one of my bosses caught a cold, and he spent more than 100 yuan to cure his cold. But one of his workers also caught a cold, but he spent no more than 30 yuan.
Most workers are not paid until they travel home, so their daily living expenses come from their boss, money that will ultimately be taken out of their wages. They are allotted around 8 yuan a day for food, which is barely over a dollar. And one worker says this just isn't enough.
We have some dishes to eat, but for breakfast, sometimes we only have tea and cold water to drink.
Over 60% of migrant workers are separated from their spouses and children. Migrant workers visit home usually only once or twice a year, and getting home isn't that easy. In Shanghai, Liao will wait in line for 2 days at the train station to get a ticket. And even then, sometimes they are sold out. When he manages to find a ticket, the ride home is far from pleasant. He stands for over 15 hours to return to his hometown in the Henan province. Despite the difficulties, though, Chung says this is the best time of year for migrant workers.
The time I feel most happy is when I get the money and get ready to go home, get the wages and go home. It's so sweet. I just want to go home and get some rest and spend time with my family.
The families of these workers are living an equally difficult life. The women and children left behind are responsible for the farmland. Tsinghua sociology professor Yuan says this is straining production.
All the strong labor is leaving the countryside, and only the old, weak, and women are left, and every quarter the production is limited.
Professor of construction management Fang Dongping says part of the problem is China is growing too fast.
You know, China is not a balanced country. In some city, the people is rich and have lots of money, even for the government. But in other areas, the people are really poor. So I don't think it's the time for China to build so many luxury high skyscrapers.
But Jonathan Hirsch believes it's a necessary part of moving China forward.
To develop an economy from being a underdeveloped country, less developed country, to a fully developed country, and I think infrastructure is a key part of that, is a key part of that, and migrants have built up China's infrastructure single-handedly.
And workers like Chung are starting to envision a different future and are dreaming of a different life.
If given the chance, I want to go back to get my education. And after graduation, I want to do anything but this job, anything but a migrant worker.
The migrant worker population is set to grow by another 200,000 workers this year in Beijing alone, and that demand will continue, leaving workers struggling to get by in the rapidly growing Chinese economy. In Beijing, I'm Lauren Thorbjornsen.
Migrant workers face an uncertain future. Living as nomads, they are always searching for better paying work. The most prized job is to work on the factory floor of one of the many foreign companies. It is the dream of many Chinese laborers because the working conditions are often much better than what local companies offer. Salaries can be double or triple what a Chinese owner might pay. Illinois-based Motorola produces cell phones in China and employs a range of Chinese workers. But it isn't only cheap labor that draws Motorola to China. The company also sees huge growth potential in a market with a population of 1.3 billion possible cell phone users. Mobile phones are everywhere in China, as Julian Sharman explains.
In Beijing, cell phones are as common as the bicycle once was. From migrant workers wanting to keep in touch with family members far away, to corporate executives running to and from meetings. The streets are full of people who are walking while talking on a mobile phone. Schaumburg-based Motorola was the first American company to enter the Chinese cell phone market in the 1980s. The Fortune 500 company got its start in China by supplying the Chinese upper class with easy-to-use pagers that were the first to relay messages in Chinese characters. Director of Corporate Communications at Motorola China's Boning Yang says Motorola is celebrating 20 years of business in China.
For instance, after 1989, Tiananmen Square thing,
a lot of multinational companies became very hesitant, and they pull out, they stopped, or they at least they put everything on hold. And Motorola didn't. Motorola just moved ahead.
Motorola's main manufacturing facility for both the Chinese market and the world is Tianjin, 2 hours southeast of Beijing. Once a desolate fishing community, Tianjin is now growing at record speed. About 50% of Motorola's product is now made in the Tianjin Economic Technological Development Area, or TETA, which houses nearly 3,700 companies within its 13-square-mile boundaries. Motorola is the largest factory. Factory director Chen Lai says the decision to move to Tianjin was easy.
And also China market is growing very rapidly. So Motorola put a lot of efforts here in China, in Tianjin, to meet the customers' needs. This is China's advantage for a high economic growing speed and for very qualified engineers, very qualified talents, and I think with low cost compared to European and US. I think this is the fact, and everybody must respect the fact.
The bi-level building can hold 37 football fields. It's nearly 30% larger than the firm's former Harvard, Illinois cell phone plant that was shut down in 2002. Operations here in Tianjin run quieter than you might expect. Employees have individual bays for assembly, fluorescent light illuminates the factory floors, and employees work to the humming of lab equipment and the persistent tone of a security checkpoint. The laborers, mostly women, are small in stature and clad in short, pastel green Motorola lab coats thrown over their casual, everyday clothing. The spotless hallways look very much like a high school corridor, and the factory assembly areas are hardly what one would consider crowded. Lai says this is done on purpose, to avoid overcrowded work areas that are typical in domestic labor facilities. 31-year-old Zheng Qian Guang has been working at Motorola for 11 and a half years. He believes Motorola offers better working conditions and does other things for the employees as well that simply do not happen at his friends' workplaces.
Our factory takes more considerable measures in management, and they care more about your daily life. For example, there are family days when they will do something for the employees, and they will also provide many employee benefits. During holidays, they may give you gifts and have annual celebrations, and in this way, they are better than other factories I know of.
Some of the employees at the Motorola facility are labor refugees from other manufacturing facilities. Concerns about safety, fire hazards, working temperatures, overcrowded workspaces, and low pay are among the many labor issues that have existed in China since the manufacturing boom began. These hazards are considered the byproducts of maintaining a low-cost work environment. However, lawyer Winston Zhao, an authority on international law and labor regulations, says we will see labor reform within the next 6 months. The most important change will involve unionization, with guarantees of employee benefits such as insurance, set pay scales, and job security.
In the past, trade union mainly plays a role as a sort of an organizer of entertainment and recreation activities. And they haven't really played a major role in the employment-employee relationship. But under the new labor law, if it's adopted, it's likely that the labor union will play a major role.
Zhao says another reform in the works will lead to a shortened test period for employees, who get less pay and no benefits while on probation. Skeptics say that labor reform would make it nearly impossible for China to maintain its position in the global economy. Fudan University Professor of International Policy and Foreign Relations Ye Jiajing says the overwhelming number of laborers available to international companies such as Motorola gives China its edge.
The major comparative advantage of China to involve in this global market is cheap labor. So we cannot lose that advantage. One way to control the labor cost is to not have so much protection, If the company has too much protection, to greatly improve the working environment, then that certainly means the increase of the cost.
International companies like Motorola are already required to abide by international safety rules and regulations. The international standards are what attract many of the 10,000 workers to the Tianjin facility, and these workers are also consumers of the products that they make. Cell phone culture, a term familiar to only the most tech-savvy Americans, is very much alive in China, where anyone from a youngster to a corporate executive will buy 2 to 3 cell phones a year to ensure they have the latest, hottest model. Cell phone stores in China are staffed by employees dressed in the latest styles,
and the decor is often futuristic, with the overtones of a downtown nightclub. Pushy salesmen roam the floors, and loud electronic music is typical. 26-year-old Beijing accountant Li Xing explains how she chooses a cell phone.
I never really care about brands. Every time I change my cell phone, I look for the design of the phone and then the functions. But I really just enjoy the looks.
According to THT Business Research, China is the fastest growing cell phone market in the world. And brisk business means promotions for some factory workers. Eileen Li is the marketing manager for Motorola University, a school where many of the skills and education that low-level assembly workers lack are taught. Li says it's Motorola's solution to the problem of a shortage of educated workers in China.
Within Motorola, we have a very good leadership supply program so that we can develop our own leaders by the program we designed particularly for our own requirements. Normally, we foresee what kind of leader we need, what kind of position in the next probably 2 or 3 or 5 years, and then we prepare people for that.
Motorola University in Beijing offers 130 different courses in both English and Chinese. University students were not allowed to comment due to Motorola policy. Although Motorola remains the chief overall telecommunications provider in China, it faces stiff competition in the cell phone market. According to Strategy Analytics, Nokia is and has been the cell phone leader, with a 28% share compared to Motorola's 20% share. Beijing cell phone salesman Zhong Guan says Nokia is better known.
I think Motorola here in China is going down in business and marketing share. Well, I guess because Nokia is just too famous here in China, and they really update their cell phone quickly. So compared to that, Motorola, they update their cell phone a little bit slowly, and it's not as fashion as Nokia. And I guess some of the domestic brands, they outweigh Motorola in some respects.
Motorola executives believe they have a very firm grasp on the desires of their customers, but it will have to make and market its phones with fewer employees. Motorola announced it will make 4,000 job cuts through 2008 as part of a $1 billion cost restructuring protocol. In response, Yang says that the U.S. has a lot of advantages in terms of innovation, research, and development, while other countries like China enjoy advantages that are labor-intensive. He also says that the governments of these countries should look at their own current strengths, try to work along those lines.
That was Julian Sharman reporting. Many people assume that job growth in China always means a loss of manufacturing jobs in the United States. And in the case of Motorola, some jobs have been lost here in Illinois. Globalization can be a double-edged sword. But as you'll hear in the next hour of China Beyond the Great Wall, some Illinois companies like Caterpillar and Littelfuse say the Chinese market is helping them expand their workforce here in central Illinois.
This brings to a close the first hour of our two-hour special China Beyond the Great Wall. In hour two, we'll take a close look at the ties that bind China and Illinois, including China's growing appetite for Illinois soybeans. We also examine the impact of the Chinese one-child policy on the elderly and the changing role of women in Chinese society. And we'll visit some of the prestigious college campuses in China to take the pulse of the next generation and their view of China's political future. Like students on college campuses everywhere, they often make social connections via the internet. And in China too, much time spent chatting or gaming can get you labeled. Look at how the Chinese are treating people they call internet addicted. Sam Unger and Lauren Torbjornsen will lead you through the next hour. I'm Michael Kuliska.
And I'm Elizabeth Murray. Thanks for listening and stay tuned for more China Beyond the Great Wall.
We would like to thank those who made this program possible. China Beyond the Great Wall was underwritten by University of Illinois Chancellor Richard Herman, the Center for Global Studies, the Center for International Business Education and Research, and Leon Dash of the Center for Advanced Study. We would also like to give thanks to University of Illinois alumni and former visiting scholars in China who offered their help and support during our visit to China. We'll be right back.
子，没有机会只能抬的影子，甚至装赢了什么冷小子，人家谁的理由如何，只敢跟我背上我的，我的倔强亮的，艰难的途中虚名一个，将